This is the Bill Kelly Show podcast.
Donald Trump is doing it again. He is in the news. He is, well, yesterday he was supposed to have a press conference and an announcement about infrastructure spending. But as so many other Trump meetings and things and forays with the media go, it was rather long and meandering. And he eventually got around to talking about trade issues and suggested that Canada is not being fair with the United States. And as a result, he even, mused about the idea of installing a border tax across the two countries to try to create some sense of fairness. Well, first of all, there's the legitimate question as to whether or not he's even able to do that or allowed to do that. But it's an idle threat. And is it a shot over the bow or is it just him thinking out loud, if he does, in fact, think? Marvin Ryder, business professor of the DeGroote School of Business at McMaster University, is with us here in studio to talk about this. Thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure, Bill.
You braved Main Street West today.
I did. The minefield, which is Main Street West.
Right out by the university and all the way actually down to almost to DeGroote's paradise. It's ridiculous. And for those who don't live in the Hamilton area, obviously we've had a bit of a thaw. Now it's cold again, so the street is in just horrible shape there.
And I know they said that they aren't planning to do anything until they build the LRT. No point rebuilding the street twice, but I just think it's so rough. Just a simple resurfacing that'll hold us for another 4 or 5 years would make a lot of sense to me.
We hope so, for the matter of public safety. All right, let's get to the issue at hand here. Donald Trump being Donald Trump once again.
From one minefield to the other.
Well, yeah, pretty much. First and foremost, are we being unfair?
Well, let me. I'm going to answer your question, but let me just back up a second. Where did Donald Trump come from on all of this? So he got asked some questions. He's proposed, I think it was $700 billion of infrastructure, but he's not even opposed to taking that number even higher, say $1 billion of infrastructure in the United States. This is to do two things. One is to help rebuild crumbling roads and bridges and airports, what have you, but it was also designed to stimulate jobs in the United States. And so somebody asked him the question, well, is this only going to be spent with American companies? To which he said, hey, you want to believe it, you know, we need countries to be fair with us. And then that led him to talk about Canada. As he got talking about Canada and he said Canada was unfair, he said that we were unfair in two ways. One, and this is, I'm trying to quote him as best I can, one he said was in farming, and the other was on border access. Now, that sent everybody scrambling because we haven't got the foggiest idea of what he was talking about, except I think his message around farming is that old bugaboo about supply management and dairy and poultry, what have you. But he didn't say that. And then border access, again, it boggles my mind. The only people who have restricted trade because of the border have been some American states. Most recently, New York State was saying that, well, this investment we're going to make is only for New York companies. Ontario companies weren't going to be allowed. This led Kathleen Wynne to say, well, if you're going to start playing that game, maybe we should do the same thing in Ontario. But we haven't restricted anything this way. And then we thought, well, maybe he doesn't mean access to trade. Maybe he meant, I don't know, the movement of people at the border. But we have a very porous border, and we work with the United States. We've lived up to all of their requirements. So to be candid, Bill, we don't know what he means. Now, yesterday, along with talking about infrastructure, the president also gave a budget to Congress. Congress traditionally always thanks the president for his or her budget whenever they submit one, and then they just throw it away and they don't really use it. There's no mention in his budget of any special taxes or reciprocal taxes. All the things he mused about just came out of left field, and we really don't know what he means.
Well, let's see if we can deal with those, if in fact you're on the right track. And you're right. I mean, who knows exactly where this guy's coming from. But if he's talking about supply management, which is basically a subsidy program the federal government what does with the dairy farmers, because it's been an issue during the NAFTA negotiations. I don't know how big an issue because they're not really talking a whole lot about that. But the reality is the U.S. government does the same thing for Wisconsin dairy farmers. I mean, I don't think the idea is very – I think it's an old-fashioned idea, and I'd like to see some reform when it comes to that. But he can't say that, well, we're doing it and we're screwing the American farmers because they're getting the same deal down there.
Same but different. So you're right, Bill. Yeah. They get support, but they don't call it supply management. And in his mind, what America does for America's farmers is fine. What Canada does for Canada's farmers isn't fine. Bill, I can share it to you this way. You again, just setting aside Trump for a moment, we've signed two very important trade deals in the last couple of years. One was the free trade deal with the European Union, and the second one is this TPP-11 Trans-Pacific Partnership involving Australia and New Zealand. In both cases, there are people who also have dairy industries and other kinds of food exporting industries, and they complained that Canada was being unfair. And in both cases, we chipped away at supply management. In the case of Europe, it was to allow European cheeses and butter into the country in a way they had not been allowed before. In the case with TPP-11, although it's not yet been ratified, the plan is to allow New Zealand and Australia to bring butter and some dairy products into the country in a way they weren't able to before. And I believe when NAFTA 2.0 is finished, whenever it's finished, we'll again have chipped away a little bit at supply management. Why I'm using language like chipped away is I don't want farmers listening to us to think, my God, they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But it is time to evolve supply management. Allow a little more competition into the Canadian market, but bridge that with farmers in whatever way. So don't shock them so they lose their farm, but bridge them to whatever the new reality is. I don't want to scare people, but if you go to Buffalo, New York, and buy a bag of milk the way we might buy a bag of milk here, they're about a buck cheaper. It has nothing to do with taxes. It has everything to do with supply management. So I'm not rooting against Donald completely on this. I'd like to see us modernize supply management and start to evolve it into a more competitive system. But we're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that's the challenge for Chrystia Freeland. If she's going to chip away at this a little bit, she's got to get something in return. So she doesn't play her cards early. She doesn't immediately come out and say, oh, yes, I'm prepared to give you X, Y, and Z with no reciprocation. She's going to say to them, reluctantly, I'll cave in a little over here, but then you're going to have to give me, say, the dispute resolution mechanism. And that's all part of the negotiation.
Yeah, but I mean, from what we've seen from Trump during these negotiations, It seems to me the most fair characterization of what he's asking for here is he says, let me do whatever I want with the dairy farmers in Wisconsin, but I want unfettered access to the Canadian market. I mean, it's not fair. He's not looking for reciprocity here. He just wants his access, and he doesn't give a damn what's going on with the U.S. farmers.
Well, that's very yes, I agree with you completely. That's very consistent with his view of trying to make America great again, meaning America's going to dominate again. I mean, America's got to win everything, and everyone else has to lose. Those have been very consistent themes. Again, I give great credit to Chrystia Freeland and our team negotiating NAFTA to not simply cave into this and to indicate that while we would love a deal, we want a NAFTA 2.0 deal, we think it's to everyone's benefit, it doesn't come with a blank check involved. And that's why we've pushed back. In his musing also yesterday about countries that haven't been fair, he mentioned Canada and the World Trade Organization, where we've taken them to appeal softwood lumber. And in appealing softwood lumber, not only did we list our specific case, but we listed 100 cases where the United States hadn't been fair to other nations around the world. This is quite unusual. Normally, when you make a case to the World Trade Organization, you only talk about how they've been unfair to you. But we're really presenting a situation where the United States had been unfair to many countries. The United States didn't like that in the least. But Chrystia Freeland's doing this to let America know that we're not going to roll over. Justin Trudeau was in the States last week in San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Chicago, saying the exact same thing. We love you. We have a great relationship. But it's got to be a relationship of mutual respect. It's not one side wins and the other side loses. And also, Bill, I'm sorry to go on like this, but the governors and the House of Representatives and the senators, they all get that message in a way that Donald Trump just doesn't seem to understand. Now, maybe it's because he's the president. Maybe it's because he feels it's his agenda. But he's the only person who doesn't seem to be giving us the respect we deserve. Everyone else seems to think we're doing a great job. So we've just got to take him every day and hope for the best.
Well, it may well be because he doesn't read anything. And that's common knowledge now, that we know that he does not read reports from staff. He doesn't read intelligence reports. He doesn't read trade reports. We're told that he will read something maybe two paragraphs long as his name's in there a lot. That's the truth. That's the way this guy operates.
He's what we call an oral learner. There are some people I know when I teach in the university who do better when they listen to me. There are other people who do better when they read a text. There are different kinds of learning styles, and he's clearly an oral learner. It even goes back to something you and I talked about. If Robert Lighthizer and Wilbur Ross get some sort of a deal with Canada, can they sell Donald Trump on it? I actually believe the answer to that is yes, because he's never going to read
he doesn't know.
The NAFTA deal. They're just going to have to give him the highlights. highlights. So if they give him the right set of highlights, he'll buy into it regardless of what it says on the paper.
Other thing about this this idea about a border tax. Here's a guy that, first of all, doesn't know his own constitution. The president of the United States cannot initiate a tax in the United States. That's only done by the Congress. So, I mean, he has no authority. You can't even do an executive order on that. He's way out of his league, and he doesn't seem to know that.
Right, and then just to take that a half step farther, as you know, at the end of December, the American Congress passed some sweeping tax legislation. They got that through. Remember, that's the hallmark as they head to these midterm elections. Look at the tax cuts we've given you and all those great things. To talk now about a new tax is just off the table. There's nobody in Congress who wants to talk about that a few months before a midterm election. And here's the other thing that Donald doesn't always seem to understand, that if I put a trade barrier up, in other words, I tax Canadian goods, who pays the tax? It's not Canadian companies that pay the tax. It's the Americans who buy the Canadian goods. It's the same way when he talks about using a tax to build the wall with Mexico. I'm going to tax those Mexican goods, but it's really Americans who will pay the tax, if he does this, to build the wall with Mexico. It's not the Mexican companies. This is a very basic part of economics. And, you know, Donald Trump says he's a smart man, but I don't think he grasps the idea that a tax on a foreign good is not paid by that foreign country.
If he's a smart man, he's doing a hell of a good job of hiding it, because he just doesn't seem to grasp these things.
Or doesn't want to grasp these things.
No, he's relying on talking points, which appeal to his base, but they're not based in reality.
Right, and I get that. It's the first president I've ever seen who does things like this, and doesn't also. It's not really held to accountable by anybody. He can, I think, probably what happens with him is he says so many different things on so many different days. You can't keep up to him. By the time you fact check one thing, he's put out four more, and you just eventually have to throw up your hands and say, "Well, that's Donald Trump's world. The sky is purple and the sun is black, and we go on from there."
And I wonder whether or not he is being held accountable. Maybe not by the American people, because he seems to get a pass from them time and time again, even when he comes out with these things. But you're getting the sense, though, that the world is looking at this. And we saw this at the NATO meeting last year, where Angela Merkel basically said, look, clearly we're going to have to get along without the United States, because this guy just doesn't get it. And we're hearing that more and more. So on the international stage, I think they're throwing up their hands. And I got to tell you, the person I'm gaining more and more respect for every time Trump opens his mouth is Chrystia Freeland, who's the lead negotiator for Canada in these talks. I don't know why she just doesn't go in and start banging her head against the wall, but she's shown great resolve in this and great patience. She doesn't take the bait, and a lot of other people would.
Well, and Bill, in giving her this kind of credit, remember, Chrystia Freeland's just an MP. She represents some constituency. She was elected in the last election. She was plucked then to say, well, why don't we put you in that post? She hasn't had deep training in this. She hasn't had deep experience. It's not like she's negotiated seven other trade deals, and yet she's doing a marvelous job. Justin got a real gem there in that ministry.
But she's got a great background in finance, though.
She has, but she's never done something like this before. And look, I'm not in her league at all, but years ago I got plucked out of obscurity to do the transition board. I'd never built a city before.
I'm still recovering from it,
but sometimes, you know, you get a lucky person in that role and they don't do that bad of a job. And she's just done marvelously here. By the way, I also want to say, I know people listening to us say we're picking on Trump. And look, doesn't Justin Trudeau say some crazy things? And yes, last week, I don't know what was going through his mind when he used the term person kind rather than mankind. But the difference between the two of them is that Justin does these odd things more rarely. And so thus, we can really focus on that one crazy thing he says and go, Justin, what were you thinking? Whereas with Trump, it's a daily and in some cases hourly occurrence, and it's just we get so used to it. So I also think Justin Trudeau is doing a great job as prime minister to position Canada on the world stage. If Trump wants to put up barriers, if Trump wants to talk about taxes, if Trump wants to make it seem like everyone's the enemy and only the Americans are the victory, he's positioned us on the world stage as the country that's open for trade, that's willing to talk, that's interested in negotiating. So that, again, take the TPP-11. This is the first free trade deal signed by Japan in its history. Japan has been notorious for putting up barriers. Trump's not wrong when he says that Japan puts on these big tariffs on American-made motorcycles to protect their own industry. But yet Japan said they would be interested in talking free trade, and Trump says, I don't want to do that. Canada said we are. And I think this is something we can't neglect, that we are positioned very well, at least during this Trump presidency, as the country that's open for trade.
I get the sense sometimes that this guy's really got his head stuck in the 1950s. This is a different world now. And I mean, you can't be an island unto yourself, not anymore, not in the international economic situation. And Trump doesn't seem to get that.
No, and I guess the question is, why doesn't he get it? Now, remember his background when we talk about him being a great business person is mostly in land development. Well, land develop, although you can do international projects, you tend to be within a country when you do a project. In other words, if I build a building in Dubai, I don't build it in Great Britain and then float it over there. I build it within that country. So I'm not sure he's had that much experience internationally. And I just don't think he realizes that some of this trade we're talking about, how it's connected. Bill, I'll give you another quick example. Mr. Lighthizer at the end of the last negotiations claimed that Canada had a $96 billion trade deficit, that we were shipping this amount of good into the United States. That's not true. What it is that amount of goods flows through Canada to the United States, but this is trade, let's say, from China that lands first in Vancouver, then gets put on a train and heads down into the United States. That's not Canadian trade. We don't count that as Canadian trade. Mr. Lighthizer decided he would. And it's that misunderstanding of how trade operates that fuels some of these comments.
Insanity. hopefully we can make some sense of it. Hopefully Chrystia Freeland and the Canadian delegation can as well. Marvin, thanks as always. Great having
you.
My
pleasure, Bill.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Now, let's get down to what's happening in the neighborhoods. Neighbors rallied around the Queen and Herkimer area in downtown Hamilton on Monday morning. Boy, it was chilly doing that, to promote their need for safety when it comes to that intersection. I've driven that 1,000 times probably in the last couple of weeks. We always use that, and it's one of the busiest neighborhoods, one of the busiest intersections in the city. And they've got some very legitimate concerns about what's going on down there. Tom Flood is one of the folks who organized the rally. He joins us on the Bill Kelly Show to bring us up to speed on this. Tom, thank you for the time. It's good to have you with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Bill.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the concerns, which should be obvious to a lot of people, but let's put these things on the table so we can talk about them.
Yeah, no problem. I mean, number one concern is, of course, speed. Speed is the real big issue on this street. We've had way too many serious crashes on this stretch of Queen from Aberdeen all the way north. But I mean, they're consecutive intersections that have had major crashes. These aren't just minor fender benders. They're, rolled vehicles, pile-ups, vehicles on sidewalks, obliterated bus shelters. So this is a 40 zone. And when you're absolutely decimating bus shelters, you're not going 40 or 50. You're taking it probably to the next level.
Well, I was going to talk about this being a school zone. I mean, that's the school, the St. Joseph's School is not too far away, but I know there are kids that do make that walk back and forth. There's always a lot of pedestrians. It's a great neighborhood. It's a walking neighborhood. I just had coffee down there with a dear friend just a couple of days ago, and we were remarking about how this neighborhood has rejuvenated and in fact such a great neighborhood architecturally, but at the same time, you're seeing younger families moving in there, and when you've got cars that are out of control and people that are driving too quickly, I'd be concerned too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've got two young boys that I take over to Lock Street for their school. They're 4 and 6 years old. We bike a lot of the time. We walk most of the other time, and it's a really scary stretch to get across. Just this morning on the way back from dropping them off, I just about got hit again at that pedestrian crossover at Herkimer. So the city has done a lot of great things. They've implemented that pedestrian crossover I just mentioned. The speed has been dropped from 50 to 40. So they're attempting to make things safer, but it's just not good enough in this kind of reckless culture of speed that we have in Hamilton.
Well, let's talk about road design and a couple of other things, because there have been some ideas that have been floated over the last little while that I thought would have been and should have been implemented some time ago. And that's, of course, two-way conversions. That configuration in the neighborhood, especially in the intersection to which you're referring, Tom, has always been problematic, and maybe it worked back in the 1930s and 40s when we didn't have too many vehicles and they didn't drive very quickly. But the times have changed, and that intersection is problematic. I think the design of it is problematic.
Yeah, well, I mean, at this point, the two-way's been given the green light to go ahead. I think construction's set to begin in 2019, and that whole island intersection at Herkimer is going to be completely redesigned, which is great. But what we're looking for is maybe expediting that to happen a little quicker. And when we do implement this new two-way, ensure that we actually have proper traffic calming measures being installed alongside, narrow lanes and other measures. you know, we're also looking maybe for some further enforcement immediately to kind of send the message that you can't speed here, and maybe any other temporary measures that we can get in the interim. But, Bill, it's really important to note that, you know, I live near Queen Street, so this is where I live, but this is an issue and an epidemic that runs throughout the entire city. It's in Dundas, it's in Ancaster, it's North End, it's East Hamilton. This is something that really affects the entire city and really shouldn't be a divisive issue with anyone having safe streets.
No, but you've heard the arguments against this, and
yeah.
I've talked to Councillor Marula. This was a couple of years ago, I guess, when Sam instituted the 40-kilometer speed limit on Kenilworth Avenue,
mm-hmm.
and there was huge outrage at that time. How could you do that? That's a main artery. What do I got? I've got to get from point A to point B, and I'm in a hurry. Notwithstanding the fact that there are schools all over the place and kids and people walking up and down the street and trying to cross the street, it works now. I'm sure there are still a lot of speeding tickets that are handed out, but I think most people buy into that after a while. But it's like trying to push a rock uphill to try to get people to understand that the neighborhood safety is the priority here. It's not how quickly you can get from point A to point B.
Yeah, that's exactly it. A lot of people like to set this up as or frame it up as an anti-car type of ideal, and it's not an anti-car. I'm not an anti-car person. I have a car. I use my car. I drive these streets just like everybody else that seems to complain about it. It's pro people and pro neighborhoods. If it's anti anything, it's anti speeding, and I think that's something that everyone can get behind. You know, I assume everybody wants their loved ones to be able to move through their neighborhood safely. You know, so if you want that, then we're in agreement. If you don't, then you should really ask yourself, why don't you want that?
Well, that's the concern here. And I'm a self-confessed car guy. You know, I don't cycle. I when I'm downtown, it's usually, you know, I'm going to my wife's office or I'm going to pick something up at the bank, whatever the case might be. So I'm driving. But at the same time, I have to have respect for neighborhoods and communities. And it's not a priority that I get there as quickly as possible. So I supported the bike lanes on Herkimer and on Charlton.
Right.
I know it's a different configuration. Get over it.
Get
over it and understand that this is the way things are going to be and learn to live with it. You might take an extra 30 seconds or 40 seconds to get to wherever it is you want to go. But so what? Is that long? Would you rather put somebody else's life at risk just because you need to get that extra 30 or 40 seconds?
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating hearing that, I guess you call it an argument of, you know, losing 30 or 40 seconds. I mean, essentially live by the golden rule. Drive in other neighborhoods the way you drive in your own. You know, that's all we're really asking.
I know, but it's like the problem here is that every time this happens and every time some of these measures are put in place, there's always going to be pushback. And I got to give the city councilors, and at least some of them anyway, an awful lot of credit because they do understand that, okay, I'm going to get pushback from other areas, but I've got to be concerned about neighborhood safety. And we saw this happen. I mean, how many years now? I mean, when I was doing the commute to Toronto many years ago, I'd come down the West Fifth Hill and I'd turn left onto Markland and cut across through that neighborhood. And
yeah.
Now, I'd like to think that I obeyed the traffic laws 99.9% of the time, but apparently a lot of people didn't. So now that's restricted. You can't do that. Okay, you know what? That's fine. You just learn to find another way. But people just don't seem to understand that. They are so egocentric, and all they care about is, I need to get someplace, get out of my way. And that's not the way that you're supposed to be in a community like this, or any community.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, speaking of city council, our councillor Farr has always had an open door for me to come in and discuss this exact issue with him. And, again, like I said, they've implemented a few changes on Queen Street. There's been calming measures all through the neighborhood, speed bumps, stop signs, you know, speed reduction. So I'm very grateful for all of those things. That's fantastic. But we're in a city with, like I said earlier, the culture of speed and getting places as fast as possible, which a lot of people pride the city on. We need to, like you said, redesign, and further changes are needed, and we need them done sooner and across the entire city.
And I get that, because there was a mindset back in the 1950s, I guess, that basically said, look, we're going to set up this series of one-way streets so you can zoom across. And there was a different attitude then. I mean, an awful lot of the people worked in the North End at that time, and a lot of people were moving up to the mountain to some of the newer developments, the newer neighborhoods there. And they had to get down to the factories and get back at the end of the day. So they did all this one-way street stuff. And I can understand that. And at that time and place, it made an awful lot of sense. But we're over that, and I think we have to just understand and maybe even accept that. The biggest problem you've got, Tom, I think, is an awful lot of people on city council still don't get the idea.
Yeah, I agree, Phil.
So what are you going to do? You did the rally yesterday, braving the cold and the miserable weather that we've had the last couple of days. What's the message you want to get across to City Council?
Well, yeah, so it's two things. Again, one is the awareness. Maybe drivers actually saw us out there and we're slowing down a little bit. But to councils, let's really expedite what we're doing on safer streets and calming measures and get it done sooner and get that conversation going and having tangible effects a lot sooner than, you know, we'll get to it later. And maybe we can start attacking Vision Zero and then moving a little quicker on that campaign.
What kind of a buy-in are you getting from your neighbors on this? I mean, notwithstanding how many people might have showed up at the rally, I mean, other things, you know, people have got work to go to and other things, so not everybody can attend these sorts of things. But the neighborhood in which you live is pretty proactive when it comes to getting things done.
Yeah, absolutely. We're pretty lucky to live in an area where people are very engaged. Pretty great response. And again, it goes across the board. People came out from all sorts of neighborhoods to support us at yesterday's demonstration. People from Corktown, the North End, all over, because we all share the same concern for speeding in our neighborhoods.
Has there been any discussion about speed limits? Because as they've done in some of the other areas about... I know that in having some off-the-record conversations with some of the city councilors over the last couple of months, there's some discussion going on. It's not official yet that they just may have the fallback speed limit for the city streets may just be 40 as opposed to the 50 or whatever it might be on some of the city streets right now. And now that's different, but I know that some other cities in North America have already gone that way. And is that something that you'd be pushing for? Is that something you'd like to see council debating?
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to have our street limits or our speed limits lowered. I'd like to get down to 30, to be perfectly honest. Anyone that's driving on one of our streets that have houses and residential on them, you know when you're driving 40 and there's cars parked along the side, if a kid runs out, that's too fast. You won't have time to stop.
You know, it's interesting. I mentioned I was down there the other day having coffee, and I was driving along Charlton towards Queen. And now that those cars are in that park lane is there, and there is restricted traffic. You know what it did to me is it made me more aware of the fact that I've got to be careful because you don't know what's going to happen. I think when you just had three lanes of traffic that was just, you know, going hell-bent for leather, heading west along Charlton, for instance, or going the other way on Herkimer, that you tend to lose that perspective and just think, I can go as fast as I want because there's nothing in my way. And subconsciously, I think you actually put the pedal to the metal a little bit more.
That's exactly right, Bill. The design has everything to do with it. A lot of people aren't even driving fast intentionally. It's not like they're acting reckless, but when you have, like you said, three lanes of open road, you can't even sometimes help it. You're just, you know, drawn to driving a little bit faster because you feel safe to do so.
Well, sure. You get a block away from the intersection to which you're talking here, Queen and Herkimer, and you've got a drugstore there, and there's people going back and forth because it's a neighborhood drugstore. You've got a variety store. There's a lot of pedestrian traffic that's there, and you've got people that are walking their dogs up and down. You don't notice that if you're going quickly. If you slow down a little bit, you understand that, okay, I can understand this now. There are people there that are relying on me to drive safely so they can be safe.
That's exactly right. You know, we should all be careful on the roads and the streets, but when you're driving a pretty heavy vehicle, there's a bit of an extra onus on yourself.
What kind of support are you getting from City Council on this? I know that the two ward councillors, Council Farr in Ward 2 and Councillor Johnson in Ward 1, have spoken considerably about road safety and about traffic calming methods. They've got your back, but are you hearing from other councillors about this? Because let me put it this way, you know, when the parking lanes went in and the bike lanes went in on Herkimer and Charlton, you know, Tom, there was a lot of pushback from some of the other councillors that said this is not right.
Oh, I remember that quite well, Phil. Yes, absolutely. But yeah, so yeah, Farr and Johnson have been very supportive. They were out of the demonstration yesterday, which is great. But yeah, you're right. It's now time to talk to everybody else because it's a citywide issue. It's not just in this neighborhood.
Do you get the sense that that maybe some of those people are starting to become a little more flexible about this and understand how important it is?
Yeah, I think so. I think all the measures that have been put in place in the last 4 or 5 years are starting to, you know, to loosen up some of the councillors' ideas on, you know, having safer neighborhoods.
You know, what's interesting about this, even the ones that were speaking out against what you guys were doing in your neighborhoods down there, they all have their own problems in their own wards. It might be a little bit different, but it's variations on the same theme, and that theme being that people drive too quickly, people don't obey stop signs, people don't pay attention to what's going on, and they don't seem to understand, or worse, don't seem to care that they're really driving through residential neighborhoods and they're not driving appropriately.
Yeah, that's exactly it. People aren't taking the care, time, respect when they're going through other neighborhoods, and it's scary. You know, people are driving 70 kilometers, 80 kilometers on these residential streets that you should be driving 30 on.
Well, you mentioned that you'd like to expedite the two-way conversion, which I think would be beneficial in to try to address some of these concerns. Any sense? I mean, they're heading into budget year right now. Is there any sense that they may try to move that ahead?
Well, I don't know yet at this point, but I, you know, emailed Councillor Farr, and hopefully we'll have a meeting with him the next week or so and go over some of these details.
Tom, stay in touch with us. Let us know what's going on. But congratulations to you and your neighbors and those who are supporting you from outside that neighborhood as well, because they understand certainly the importance of what you guys are doing here about safety. You know, one injury is one injury too many. One accident is one accident too many. And the more that we can do to try to alleviate that, the better off we're all going to be in this community.
That's right. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Okay, thanks again, Tom. Stay in touch.
Okay, bye.
Tom Flood from that neighborhood organizing the rally yesterday. And I know, look, I talked to some of the counselors at the time that questioned the legitimacy of putting the bike lanes in and the parked lanes that are on Herkimer and Charlton right now. But this is all about traffic calming. And if your major complaint is it slows you down, that's what it's supposed to do. That's the purpose, to slow people down, because they were driving too quickly. And maybe that doesn't matter to you if you live up on the mountain, for instance, or you live in Dundas or Ancaster, and you're in a hurry to get to the hospital. You're in a hurry to get out and go to the LCBO over on Dunder. It doesn't matter. It's a neighborhood. And you'd want that same kind of respect in your neighborhood. You'd want people to obey traffic laws and traffic signals and look out for kids and be careful about what's going on in the neighborhood. And it's a matter of mutual respect that if you'd like to see that in your neighborhood, then you should also be cognizant of that when you drive into those people's neighborhoods. And that's really what it comes down to. So I applaud these people. I applaud them for being proactive on this and trying to get some things done. And yeah, Klaus Wagner from Hamilton Police Services is on the program often. Of course, he talks about traffic safety because that's his wheelhouse. That's what he's so good at, of course, with Hamilton Police Service. And he'll tell you, you know, when you know he stops people for traffic infractions or for speeding, whatever. There's a number of different things that we'll get pulled over for. Or, I mean, some people driving too quickly through school zones, some people ignoring school buses, you know, when the stop sign goes up on the school bus. It's ridiculous what some people do. Well, I was in a hurry. Too bad. And if it's going to make you late, if the traffic calming is going to make you late, leave earlier. It's a simple solution. If you always leave the house at 8 o'clock and know I'm going to be an extra 3 minutes late, leave the house at 7:55. And that way everybody's safe.
You're listening to The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.
Interesting what's happening. We know that the federal government has, and the provincial government for that matter, are adamant that by summertime that pot's going to be legal in this country. And they've had some discussions about how that's going to roll out, and boy, that's not without controversy. But with all of that in mind, police here in Hamilton have been ramping up raids on storefront pot shops. Some of the operators say they were raided as late as last week. So what's going on? Well, joining us to talk about this is Clint Young, who is the CEO of MMJ Canada, who have, I believe, three locations here in Hamilton. Clint, thank you for the time. It's good to have you with us today.
Hey, Bill, how are you? Thank you very much for having me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your circumstance here. I mean, because this has been an ongoing concern. I mean, the government's talking the talk right now, but the police, and not just here in Hamilton, but in other jurisdictions, I'm told, seem to be ramping up enforcement on this. What's going on? What are they telling you?
Yeah, just quickly there, Bill, before we get into it, I'm just so you know, I'm a good friend of your son, Sean's there. I've known him for about 16 years there.
I think Sean's probably listening right now, so give a shout out to him.
Probably.
he's on his break right now.
What's going on right now? You know, what you're seeing is essentially probably a push from the politicians. You know, when I hear things kind of like, you know, the police are ramping up, I'm not quite sure I really agree with that, Bill. And the only reason is that, you know, every time that we've ever had to deal with the police, they've been absolutely amazing. You know, the standard that they're setting when they come in, the way that they're treating the staff, the way they're kind of viewing things is, you know, is as positive as it could get.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point because, you know, when you use a term like they raided a place, I think that conjures up a picture in your head that they kicked open the front door with axes and sledgehammers and started smashing stuff and throwing guys on the floor and putting handcuffs on them. That's not the way it worked out, I understand.
No. You know, they were really good to all the staff. The three managers that were on site at each location were released in, like, you know, I think a half an hour is what they said. Again, the police have to react. No matter how much they say don't agree with maybe enforcing and or think it's a non-issue and, you know, there's bigger things to deal with, unfortunately, the police still have to do their job. You're going to hear a lot of operators maybe be a little more aggressive towards them. It's not who I am, Bill. I'm looking at this from a business point of view and a bigger picture. The fact is that there was unfair regulations that were announced. It's put everybody in a really complicating position, from licensed producers to retail storefront operators to the police. Everybody is kind of has to do what they have to do until either this craft market is included and or medicinal market is included. And that's one thing. And another thing, sorry, I kind of want to touch on is that, you know, medicinal and recreational are completely two different types of cannabis stores and businesses, and they need to be regulated as such. We cannot be blanket statemented anymore as we're all the same, because we are not all the same. We're very, very differently medicinal to recreational.
Let's talk about that difference, because you're absolutely right. An awful lot of people, Clint, just wouldn't understand that unless they actually walk through the door or they have a prescription or they're users.
Yes. Okay. So do you kind of want me to walk you through the process, Bill? Okay, so the, you know, recreational is very simple. I think everybody knows that. You know, if you're 19 or over and you have your ID, go on in and shop. That's it. That's all. With MMJ Canada, you either have to see our on-site naturopathic doctor and or have your federal license from Health Canada. To have your federal license through Health Canada, you have to apply through either a doctor, which I refer everyone to Dr. Ira Price, who runs Synergy Health, to get their license, because he signs people up for free and doesn't charge anyone. Where there's a lot of doctors out there right now that are charging like $200 to get your possession license. So we send all of our patients either up to him and or to see the on-site naturopathic doctor, and then you get a card and then you can shop. But all of our staff have been trained through a Colorado institute called the Tricom Institute, and on responsible vendoring courses, harm reduction, strain specifics. Canada did not even have a program, Bill, for me to kind of look to, not for the regulated side of the market and or the gray side of the market, or however the government wants to refer us as.
Well, that's kind of short-sighted, isn't it?
Yeah.
They said they were going to legalize this. They said they were going to put the protocol in place. You'd think at some point somebody would have said, well, what about training? We'll get to that later.
Well, they are now, right?
It's a little late. It's the 11th hour.
Yes, no, you're correct, Bill. But again, you know, better late than never, some would say. For me, you know, in Vancouver, what's different between Ontario and what everybody, I want everyone to remember is that, you know, MMJ Canada comes from Vancouver, and, you know, they had things going for about 10 years longer than Ontario. There's always been people in the mix who wanted training programs, have been kind of brainstorming the idea. So it's not that the process hasn't been there or the ideas haven't. But when America states legalized before us, like individually, they clearly instantly had to have a program up and running. So I went out of my way, because Canada didn't have it, went over to Colorado and met Max Montross from the Tricom Institute. And I had every single one of my my bud tenders go through the training to be properly educated on how to deal with people, whether they get out of hand, whether they're whether they need to be taught about microdosing. It's a full spectrum, and it's nice to see now, Bill. I can say Lyft has a course coming out, Lyft Media. Canna Handbooks has one coming out, and then I believe Dr. Ira Price also has one coming out. So although late, it's really neat to see that people are opening up their ears. They're starting to listen to people when they speak. They're starting to understand that education is key. And they're moving forward now. So I'm very happy one way or another.
I want to shed some light on exactly what you guys do, because I think that's pretty important. And I came across this over the last number of years, just in talking to not just people like you, but people in the medical profession. and the use of medical marijuana that a lot of people maybe don't quite understand, that it is an effective tool and it's a widely accepted tool now for chronic pain management in many different facets. And I think people that might be skeptical about that, Clint, would also be probably surprised to understand that an awful lot of people in that are professionals, that are dealing with chronic pain and a number of different issues right now, are users of this stuff. And they rely on places like yours to be that access point for them.
Yes, of course, Bill. That's 100% right. And, dispensaries being the heart of the access for people who are not well, I've also found, Bill, the people that don't believe that it's good or a good medicine are the ones that are just naysayers of the industry in general. And you're going to get these people on all aspects of life, whether you're talking about cannabis, whether you're talking about gambling, alcohol, or whatnot. There's always going to be people that don't have your same view. Those are the same people that don't believe it's a medicine. And instead of wasting my time trying to convince and repeatedly try to beat it into them that it's a medicine, I'm now focusing on people who want to have open ears. There's a millions upon millions of people, Bill, that want to be educated, that want to hear what we have to say. So I realize now, focusing my energy and trying to convince naysayers, it's not always worth the time that you're giving them.
Well, there's no sense beating your head against the wall, but the reality is that it's become more and more acceptable now. I mean, when I was the moderator for the National Scleroderma Conference, which is a chronic disease and an autoimmune disease, and people go through an awful lot of pain. I don't just mean discomfort, but chronic, constant pain, as they do with things like Crohn's and colitis. And, well, you know the list, Clint. There's a whole long list of diseases like that. That this is a well-known and well-accepted method of pain management. And it's not just, hey, lighting up a joint, which is, again, something people might think. There are various products that are available to people that have this kind of prescription to be able to use this stuff.
And what I find really interesting, too, Bill, the people that don't understand or, that don't want to believe that it's a medicine, for every one, I'd say that there's 10 that realize it now that it is a medicine. So, I guess the only way to help a scenario out where people don't believe that is simply just keep talking about it. Now, the fact is, cannabis helps on multiple different levels, from fibromyalgia to MS to HIV. It's suppressed cancer in breast cancer. It suppresses cancer in other forms. It's known for helping for sleep. It's also great for anxiety and stress. The fact is that it's either for you or it's not. The only thing I can suggest to anybody who's listening is to go down and educate yourself, whether it's at an educational cannabis center, whether it's at MMJ Canada, whether it's at another dispensary that you shop at. Educate your mind. There's tinctures. There's bath bombs. There's personal lubrication. There's stuff for dogs. There's non-psychoactive stuff for senior citizens. There's non-psychoactive stuff for people who do not like feeling the euphoric stone that THC gives you. There is so many products out on the market right now that, one would be foolish to just assume that it's only just smoking. I would say these days, Bill, smoking is the last thing that I get from majority of my customers when they come in. Now, flower will always be the classic go-to pain relief for the cannabis user that's been medicating with cannabis for years. I think there's a nostalgia that comes with it in the process of rolling the cannabis and knowing what you're getting and touching and feeling that people like. But a lot of vaporizing's happening now, a lot of tinctures, microdosing, I'm getting edibles. A lot of people are doing it sublingually. So you're getting a lot of different methods. And I mean, I'm getting everybody, Bill, all walks of life from 19 years old up to 75. I'm getting people coming in with their dogs. I'm getting people come in for their grandmother who can't walk anymore for arthritic bombs. It's really not what sometimes is put out into the universe by either media or government posts or whatnot. It's not really what that is going on. If you really just simply come in and investigate yourself, you would realize that what you've been taught or what you believe really isn't the case. Like you, Bill, like you've been around the block, you've seen it come and go. You were probably at a time where cannabis was really demonized as well in your prime. And now, the fact that I'm speaking to you and you're saying, it's known for things like Crohn's, fibromyalgia, colitis, that is unbelievable that I'm speaking to a man who came from a generation where it really wasn't accepted, that really does know the
well,
facts.
Well, yeah, because in those days, Clint, in those days you dealt with pain with chemical pharmaceuticals. You know, you went to your doctor, yeah. You got a prescription for Oxycontin or any number of other things. And, I mean, and we all know what can happen with that. So this is an alternative, and it's become accepted, which is why, thankfully, the federal government and the provincial governments and many jurisdictions in the states are finally starting to see the light, and they're legalizing this. So that's where we are, and that's the rock and the hard place that you're in right now. You saw this, so you've opened up these businesses. You got three of them here in town. The police are doing what the police are having to do. I mean, that's their job. Yeah. You're absolutely right. But the concern that you probably have here is looking down the road to when this is going to become legal, and we're told it's going to be this summer, the province has basically said that they're only going to allow these things with LCBO-run outlets. What's that do to your business?
Bill, you know what, again, that the term was quite vague. If you kind of really pay attention to the fine line of what they were saying, it'll be distributed at LCBOs for recreational cannabis. Now, this is where it is very key that everybody needs to understand medicinal cannabis dispensaries are completely different than recreational dispensaries. And although that they've only spoken about the recreational market, that is Wynn's announcement. Her announcement was for recreational cannabis. It was not for medicinal. They haven't even spoken about medicinal yet. I think that they're all still kind of curious on how they go about it. It's such a finicky topic because once you're playing with patients and constitutional rights of patients, it's not as cut and dry as just eliminate this shop. To me, being medicinal, Bill, I believe in my heart, I sit with the city in the next 3 hours at 1:30 to kind of sit down at the round table with Ken and the rest of the staffers to kind of figure out a regulation for potentially for this. And I do believe in my heart, with everything that we're doing, I think that we can carve out a medicinal market in Ontario, well, in Hamilton. And I believe, regardless of, say, the city can and cannot help us, I believe we can win that challenge if it goes all the way to court for a medicinal-based dispensary. We all fear a little bit, Bill, but the fact is that you got to be ready to go on any level. You got to be able to get your business and be prepared to adapt to whatever comes. Start speaking to the licensed producers, the growers, to see if there's a way that you can protect yourself that way. Start opening lines of communication with the municipalities. Start opening lines of communication with the province and even the federal government. The fact is that if the lack of education, which we both know is clearly out there, that even runs up, Bill, into high government. We need, as operators, to keep educating the government and keep pushing forward that there is a very, very distinct separation between medicinal and recreational. And until someone says medicinal dispensaries are not welcome and will never be accepted, I am not backing down from my stance.
They can't come up with that conclusion because that's going to be problematic for the people that use it right now for pain management. And, there has to be accessibility. It's one thing to say, okay, here's your prescription for this, but I don't know where to go. And besides, you know, Clint, and I've tried to have people on in the past that talked about this when the debate was going on in Ottawa about legalization, that this is already a growth industry, the medical marijuana industry. I mean, I talked to a gentleman who's got a manufacturing facility up in Stainer, up near Collingwood, that's doing great business. And he was on one of the panels that I was moderating about pain management. And this is not Cheech and Chong we're talking about. And I'm sorry for the characterization, but that's, again, the headspace some people are still in. This is a legitimate medication, and it's like any other medication. I mean, we ought to put that codicil into it, that it can be abused. I mean, you have to follow directions. You have to follow, prescriptions, amounts, and if you exceed that, there are going to be problems. But if used properly, it's a very effective tool, which means the government has to, when they roll this out in the summertime, it's absolutely essential that they include the medical marijuana aspect in the legislation.
Of course, Bill, you're 100% you're correct. And you know, it's funny, I'm not upset at all about your Tommy Chong reference there. Actually, Tommy Chong's a great man. I was speaking with him about a month back, and he actually, he cured himself of cancer with CBD oil and THC oil. So it's funny that kind of reference came up because he actually preaches medicinal across the board now. Even with Tommy Chong being Mr. Cheech and Chong, those days are even gone for him, Bill. That's how far we've come. So it's,
that's why Tommy, because he's at that stage now where he needs pain management.
That's it.
I tell you, Clint, it happens to all of us. Look out.
I know. I'm getting up there myself, Bill. As you know, that your son Sean's getting up there with me. So,
that you're dealing with this with the police right now. They're doing their job, and we understand that. We're by the way, were any charges laid during any of these incidents?
Yes, of course. The one manager from each store got charged with possession under 3 kilograms times three, and then proceeds under crime times 5,000. That happened to myself at the very first raid almost 2 years ago, Bill, when I'll be going to court in about a year and a half. The last time they raided about a year ago at Ottawa Street, the manager at the store took the charges there at the time, and I just kind of signed as a designation that the store was mine anyways, and they end up with a peace bond. So there's a major disconnect again between the government and the judicial system in this scenario, where really nobody in the courts are finding any of these people guilty.
There's the problem, because I know that one of your compatriots and one of the other businesses went to court, and the Superior Court essentially said, but we can't do anything about it. Nobody seems to know what to do here.
Yeah,
everybody's scratching their heads.
Yeah, you know, and that's what I mean. That's why when I hear people, like, you know, battering the cops and stuff, I think to myself, wow, you know, if anybody's put in the worst position, besides patients, patients are always the ones who lose the most, Bill. But besides that, when you talk to these police officers, from my understanding, from my staff, because I was out of town, they said that the cops were like, you know, we don't like really doing this. You have a beautiful establishment. This is a really awkward scenario for everyone. Nobody knows really what to do. Everyone is on the same page. It is such a cluster mess of lack of structure and clearly not a good one set up by the Ontario government, which is, you know, I think it has been proven by the amount of complaining, not just from dispensaries, though. That's what's beautiful. You're getting police that are complaining. You're getting fire people that are complaining. You're getting licensed producers. I mean, the ones that the government have regulated complaining. You know, everyone is complaining that there's something that has to give and switch and change.
Well, they will. But unfortunately, you know, the wheels of government move awfully slowly. Cluster mess. Thanks a lot for cleaning that up for us for radio, Clint. We got to break it off right now. We're just about out of time. But look, let's stay in touch as this develops over the next little while. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks, Bill. Have a wonderful day, man.
You too. Clint Young, of course, bye-bye. The CEO of MMJ in Canada. And I like I say, I'm totally sympathetic to the police situation, to the situation in the courts, and to the people that are dispensing the medical marijuana, because nobody really seems to understand exactly what's going on, and the government's kind of getting around to it.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on AM 900 CHML.